You are listening to KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio. That's 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and around the world, streaming at kfai.org. This is Write On Radio, KFAI's podcast of the written word, and my name is Molly. And this week on the show, I am talking to Karen Lord, Annalee Newitz, and Malka Older, the editors of We Will Rise Again, Speculative Stories and Essays on Protest, Resistance, and Hope, just out in early December 2025 from Saga Press. And one reason I was excited about this collection is that it pairs speculative fiction stories with essays and interviews. And the writers of the stories were able to talk with activists and organizers and other people engaged in change-making work, all of which I think really anchors the book in our world, in our present, while also casting lines out to other possible futures and, you know, alternate realities. And as Annalee mentions in the interview, all three editors also really embody this multidisciplinary mode. So Karen Lord is a Barbadian editor and writer of speculative fiction and fantasy, as well as nonfiction work ranging from sustainable development in Barbados to sociology of religion. Annalee Newitz is a writer of science fiction and science nonfiction based in the Bay Area. They have a monthly column in New Scientist magazine and were, until very recently, the co-host of the Hugo-winning podcast Our Opinions Are Correct, which just wrapped its seven-year run this year. Malka Older is a writer, aid worker, and sociologist. She is the executive director of Global Voices, a community of journalists, editors, translators, and activists providing community journalism from all over the world. And she is a faculty associate at Arizona State University, where she teaches on predictive fictions. One technical note, in the first part of the interview, you'll hear Annalee mention a labor organizer they had lunch with in the Bay Area early on in this book's process. We had an unsalvageable microphone glitch right as they were saying this organizer's name. So the organizer is Andrea Dellendorf, who we will mention again later in the conversation and who is also interviewed in the book. All right, here's our interview about We Will Rise Again. Annalee Newitz, Karen Lord, and Malka Older, welcome to Write On Radio. It is really, really great to have all three of you here to talk about We Will Rise Again. It's the anthology that you co-edited that just came out in early December. And yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure.
So I want to start at the very beginning of the book. So the introduction gives us a peek into the book's origin story, which is very cool. And Annalee, you did something I love to do, but I'm always incredibly nervous about, which is reach out to someone who I really respect and ask them to like work on a project with me. And so there's this moment at the very beginning where you email Karen and are like, Karen, I have this idea. Will you work on this with me? And do you remember like how you felt when you sent Karen that first email? Like what was going on for you in that moment?
I thought the power differential was the other way around, Annalee.
I mean, I've been following Karen's work for a really long time. And I had met her many years before at a convention and we'd had a really nice conversation. And but I definitely still thought of Karen as just a super cool writer who I admired, and, you know, a colleague, but we didn't know each other that well. And so I was a little bit nervous. I think I wasn't worried that Karen would have a negative reaction, but we're all super busy people. And so I kind of just worried that I would send her an email and I would just never hear back because she has like a million people asking her to do things. And so I was just so happy that I feel like she had been thinking about these issues a lot herself. And so, you know, I think that was part of what really made us excited to work together. And I was just glad because, like I said, I'd been reading her work for a long time and I was like, I feel like we're on the same page. and we were. So it was really great.
I just want to jump in and say that this was during the pandemic, first of all. So the idea that there were tons of people, you know, begging me to do things was not really quite so much happening. But it really was a time when there was so much changing. You know, we had more virtual events happening. We were trying to find ways to maintain connections. So in many ways, there was always like sometimes new types of things being suggested. In terms of how I knew Annalie, as I said, I felt the power differential. I felt Annalie is definitely like better known. And I don't want to use the word more famous than, it doesn't sound right. But let's just say that my respect for Annalie is already very high and was already very high at that time. So to hear from them on this idea, to know it was a cool idea from a cool person, was just an immediate draw.
And what was cool about it to you? Like, what was it about Annalie's pitch that you were like, yes, I'm in?
You know, it's kind of funny. When you're a writer, there's some ways in which you think that what you do can be kind of trivial. You know, you're entertaining people, which is nice, but sometimes entertainment can be just a distraction and so forth. And then there are other times where you want it to be meaningful, but even that being meaningful can be a bit of a trap. Because you don't want to be in a situation where you are almost like propagandizing or preaching and so forth. Some people like lean too heavily on that. And there was something about the way Annalie pitched this to me that kind of just hit my sweet spot, where we were talking about something that we both cared about very deeply and were excited about. And the way in which they were suggesting it, the whole like making sure there was a firm basis for, yes, we're doing fiction. Yes, we're doing things that aren't real, but we're going to ground it in reality. I was like, hang on, you know, this feels a little different from the average anthology invitation. I want to go with this and see where this goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And Malka, it seems like you also, like when Annalie and Karen reached out to you, that there was something in their, in this idea, in their pitch, that really like was a big yes for you immediately. What was it for you about this project that was like, okay, even if there are a lot of other things that I could be doing, as there always are, what was it about this that was a big yes for you?
Yeah, it was an immediate yes. And part of that, of course, goes to the two of them because both of them are writers I admire, but we'd also interacted somewhat. I'd met both of you separately. I don't know if I've still ever been in the same actual room with the two of you at the same time.
I think so. Not maybe.
Both of us at the same time.
Yeah.
but we, you know, I'd meet each of them at different places separately. And then we had also had these conversations on the Sparkle Salon, which was this kind of fun conversational webinar thing, video streaming that we used to do because, you know, in the pandemic, like just having this connection was so important. And that's the thing, like, it was great, like they were great conversations and we were happy to put them out in the world. And I'm sure it was a little bit of publicity for all of us, but mostly it was always such a wonderful experience to have those conversations. It really felt so good talking to both of you as well as to the other people who are in that group. And so that was obviously just like, yes, I do want to talk to these people more. I will have Zoom conversations with them about like publishing schedules and following up on editing. And yes, that is a yes. But also, yeah, the idea was a fantastic one because, I don't know, I've talked about the idea of speculative resistance for a long time and that we need to have imagination. We need to be able to see how things can be different and really project that, yeah, this is not inevitable. There's changes possible. And that means using what fiction is good at in creating these plausible futures that people can believe in them. So I thought, from that perspective, this was a really important project to undertake. And of course, as Karen said, also, you know, the idea that it's grounded in the idea of, yeah, we're going to work with people who do this work regularly in the present. And that's how we're going to speculate from there. That's also really important.
Yeah, I wanted to add that one of the things that brings Karen and Malka and I together is that we've all done work that is fictional as well as in the real world in terms of organizing and thinking about politics and culture And that's not always a given, you know, like a lot of fiction writers, all they do is fiction and that's awesome. But we all really, we have academic backgrounds as well as, you know, other kinds of nerdy interests. Yes. And we really wanted to be able to reach out to movement leaders and activists and say, like, tell us what you do in the real world so that we can make our stories feel lived in.
I think that is one of the things about this book that is really special. Like, my experience as a reader of the book is that it was going on in the background of the book the whole time, these conversations that the authors of the stories were having with other people. Like, they were talking to organizers, activists, journalists, like people on the ground in various ways. And then, like, sometimes in the artist statements at the end of the stories or in some of the, like, transcribed interviews, we would get this glimpse of, like, how generative and important those conversations were. Yeah. So how did you facilitate all of that happening? And, like, as editors, why was that really crucially important to you?
Okay. I got to answer this one.
Go for it.
So, first of all, there were definitely authors that we invited who already had some activists that they had a connection to or tied to or some theme that they were already very interested in. But for the others who were interested but did not necessarily have a chosen topic, we had a virtual conference. And the reason why I'm sounding so excited about this is because we did this thing across time zones. I mean, when you look at us, we're already, you know, kind of spanning a few time zones already. But by the time we brought in the authors, we had people from Malaysia to the Pacific Coast. And we wanted to make sure we had something that was accessible to everybody, taking into account not only people who are working, but people who may not be with us on a Saturday and so on and so forth. And it was just this again during the pandemic. And we have to thank Arizona State University, the SU, because they gave us some funding to help to do the whole Zoom room complexity of that. but it was just so exciting and amazing to be able to have that. There are things I have done before and since where you don't always manage to get such a large number of people and such a broad range of people from so many different countries and backgrounds. Because if you are doing an in-person event and you have to fly people in, or even if you're doing a virtual one and you're just focusing on a narrow band of time zones, you're missing out on so much. And the fact that we, you know, really like tried our best to make this as global a thing as possible is something I still feel very proud of and very excited about.
We asked all the authors to pick someone, which, as Karen said, was sometimes really easy for people and sometimes a bit more challenging, and to do some kind of chat with them or interview to inform their story. It's, you know, I think it's something that we're not always used to as authors. I mean, there's one level of not being used to it, which is when you're asked to write for a themed anthology of some kind and you have to write a story to order, which is, like, I always find that it's very different from just writing whatever I feel like. Sometimes I enjoy it because it's this constraint-based challenge, like a crossword, you know, it's kind of fun, but it is a bit more stressful because you don't know if it's going to come in the right way. And then to add on to that, that you're going to talk to someone and incorporate what they say into your work, it's like that extra thing. But it was great. I think most of the authors really appreciated it in the end because it does give this grounding to the work. And of course, you know, we asked people who were already, you know, cared deeply about some issues or had a commitment to some cause. And so for a lot of them, it was really exciting to have a reason to talk to people about it and dig deeper. And then, yeah.
Almost cathartic, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And then the conference itself, I mean, it is not actually easy to organize an online conference and make it really exciting and useful. And this one really was. Like, I was also amazed at the quality of discussion that we had, which is why we ended up putting the transcripts in the book, because we weren't actually planning to do that. And we were just like, this is so good. We can't, you know, we don't want wisdom to be lost because a lot of the activists were just incredible people who had so much to tell. And then the questions from the authors were very good too. And so having that discussion and being able to give that to our readers was just fantastic.
Yeah, and I should say that, you know, really for me, the first inspiration for this anthology came from talking to an activist. And she's a labor organizer here in the San Francisco Bay Area where I live. And I had just had a lunch meeting with her to talk about the future of labor organizing, because that's something I'm very interested in as a union member, as much as I can be a union member. And she said to me, listen, what I can do is much more limited than what you can do as a science fiction writer. And I really want something out there that I can point to for activists to say, like, listen, this is what we're aiming for. This is how we bring imagination into our politics, because when you run out of imagination, when you're told that it's the end of the world and everything is terrible, you stop having hope and you stop having energy to continue the struggle, which does require a lot of energy. And so it really was a conversation between activists and speculative fiction authors, like from outset. It was always about what can we do for each other? How can we learn from each other? Because that's the most important thing.
Yeah, that speaks to, I thought a lot about genre when I was reading this book. And I think it messes, like the collection messes with genre in a way that I find very delightful. Like it does feel right to describe it as speculative fiction, but also in the stories, there are elements of fantasy, there's some magical realism, there's some like hard sci-fi, and then there's also, of course, like the nonfiction essays and like some memoir and some interviews, and there's just all kinds of things. And then in your interview at the in the introduction with Walida Imarisha and Adrienne Marie Brown, who edited Octavia's Brood, which came out a decade ago, they talked about Octavia's Brood as visionary fiction. So then we've got another like genre concept in the mix. So yeah, I mean, thinking about this and the connection to hope, which I think is really a through line of the book, just like regardless of how we name the genre, what for you all is the common thread that runs through all the pieces of this book and then maybe also like back into the lineage of storytelling that it comes from?
I'm going to drop a word in, numinous. Remember, we started with that word numinous. There's something about creativity that requires a relationship with the numinous, but specifically the numinous and the mundane. Because, you know, like I said, we're dreaming, but we're also grounded. We're imagining the future, but we're also connected with our present and with our past. So there's a way in which to be true creators, I think you have to feel almost like a sense of holiness about it and not be embarrassed by that. It's a magic in the best possible way.
Yeah, and it's great that you use the word numinous, Karen, because that was kind of what brought the anthology together, because Karen had been talking about this in the Sparkle Salon. And when I emailed her, I was like, I really loved what you said about the numinous. Like, we have to do a book where we bring that in. And I think that's true, because, again, that's really where hope comes from, is being able to kind of transcend your mundane circumstances and think about alternate possibilities. And that does require having some space and the ability to just take some time to sit down with a book or sit down with a person and have a conversation. And that's such a luxury and a rarity, especially right now. And so that's why even just the act of reading a story in this book can kind of take you out of your everyday and maybe give you a little glimpse of how things could be better. Or worse.
Sometimes both in the same story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So about things sometimes being better and worse in the same story, I was thinking, so very recently, I just read The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. I read them like back to back. And these are like two absolute classics of speculative fiction. They're also extremely different. But I think one thing that a commonality that I felt between them is that they are both very like ambivalent. Like there's a lot of contradiction and like uncertainty, and like they don't necessarily give you clean answers. And I really experienced that reading this collection as well, which I really appreciated because I have been doing organizing work of various kinds since I was in college. And that, you know, there are lots of things in here that reflect my experience as an organizer. You know, there's lots of meetings and there are people whose, you know, struggles and interpersonal relationships are, you know, really impact the work. And I mean, there's all kinds of things. But what I really appreciated was that also represented were so many of my like deepest doubts and confusions, and thinking about, you know, like what are the possibilities and also limits of mass protest. Also, like I feel like I'm forever in this like will they, won't they dance with anarchism. So the story about the anarchist town in Kansas, I was like, I really feel this one. So anyway, there's a lot of like really amazing kind of disagreement and tension within the pieces of collection and then like between them. And yeah, I like a deep curiosity that I have is, was that intentional on your part as editors, or was it sort of emergent from the stories and conversations themselves, or some combination of both?
Well, first of all, I feel like you have given us so much praise in that one question between the initial comparison, like the comp to the dispossessed is kind of amazing. And then, you know, saying that it reflected your experience as an activist, that's definitely what we were hoping for, that people who are in movements or collective action for in whatever way would see some of their experience reflected in this. So really happy to hear that. And, you know, the uncertainty was, I think, you know, in part, it's built into the concept because we are not here to tell everyone how to fix everything in detail. And that was also one of the challenging things, I think, about writing these stories, was finding ways to make them feel complete as stories and give the reader some closure while also not saying, okay, we've solved the world, because we're not. But we did want to give people some ideas. We did want to create, you know, we wanted to have a way to project some possibilities for how activism and collective action could look different in various futures or fantasies. So like we hoped it was specifically productive in some of those ways, but, you know, also to have the numinous, you need that space, you need uncertainty. And not only that, but also because the other piece of this endeavor, the other piece of this collective action, the other piece of solving all the world's problems and just making the world a little bit better, which is what we're trying to do, is the reader. And so we needed to have a space for the reader to be actively participating in the book somehow, and having the uncertainty there is just so vital for that.
I also think that we didn't do this deliberately, but as we began to narrow down the table of contents and realize kind of what stories were going to be in and how it's going to be shaped, we realized there was a really broad emotional range in the stories too. And I think this also goes back to that element of storytelling that's really ambiguous and that isn't something that you can measure in a beaker. And so much of our activism and collective action are based in our feelings for other people, our feelings about oppression, you know, how people begin to question their circumstances when they're unhappy all the time, or when they're terrified all the time, and when things that seem like they should be simple become sadistically complex. And so we have some stories like Vita James' story, Chupacabras, which is just full of wrath, full of anger, full of violent retribution. Also fantastical retribution, because as much as it would be fun, none of us can actually turn into to werewolves or giant toothy dogs, although that would be great. And then some of the stories are much more thoughtful, or they take a more journalistic perspective. So it feels like you see a whole community, like Izzy Wasserstein's story about Kansas, where we're seeing the community, but we're getting this kind of larger view of many different things that are going on. And so we wanted to have all of that too. We wanted to see, we wanted people to feel seen in their rage and also feel seen in their sort of nerdy policy planning parts where they were like, okay, the solution is a white paper. And it's like, you know what? Sometimes the solution is a really good white paper.
I wanted to add, because you said something very interesting, you know, you said uncertainty. Uncertainty is also, to me, very much linked to timing. Because a lot of times, it's funny, we were all supposed to provide a story for this anthology. So Annalise written a story and Malcolm's written a story. But I provided a co-written story with Tobias Bakel, which is a reprint. It's a 10-year-old story. But what it does is it shows that protest is often a generational project, that you're not going to see the massive change you want to see in your lifetime, but the work you do in your lifetime is foundational to the outcome that's going to happen further down the line. The other word I think about, which is to me, it's a bit of a science fiction word because that's where I encountered it, is Kairos from Madeleine Lengel's work, A Wrinkle in Time and so forth. Kairos is the opportune time. You don't know if you're going to be the person at the opportune time that sees the change, or if you're the person who's laid the foundation for it. So the kind of hope you have is not the hope of a protagonist in their own story who's the one who gets to go yay at the victory, but literally, you know, this is the real world, and you know, we're all kind of building on what the ancestors did before and putting in our bit and hoping the descendants are going to have an easier time. So yes, for timing's sake, we have to not only embrace uncertainty, but also embrace the fact that it may not be a solution or a result that we see in our lifetime.
This is Right On Radio on KFAI. I'm Molly, your host, and I am speaking to the editors of the new collection, We Will Rise Again, Speculative Stories and Essays on Protest, Resistance, and Hope. We will be back after a short break. Welcome back to Right On Radio on KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio. My name is Molly. I am speaking to Karen Lord, Annalee Newitz, and Malka Older, the editors of the new collection, We Will Rise Again, Speculative Stories and Essays on Protest, Resistance, and Hope. Yeah, Karen, so I'm glad that you mentioned your story and this, you know, theme within it of generational planning and generational work. So yeah, the stories in the collection are this like really rich tapestry, especially about protest and about like autonomous organizing, or like in a less jargony way, like just people coming together in their communities of various kinds outside of any formal institutional structures. Like there's really, a kaleidoscope of stories about that kind of work. And maybe because of my own preoccupations, I did feel like the collection was a bit tilted in that direction and had relatively few stories of what we might call like institution building strategy. Like I'm thinking particularly of labor organizing. And of course, Annalee, like there was also the interview with Andrea Dellendorf, who you were talking about as the person who, the labor organizer who you talked to at the very beginning of this process. Like they're the themes, like they come in and out a little bit, but like labor organizing or, building tenants unions, or I don't know, just like other kinds of long-term institution building, maybe power building strategies. I did feel like that was like a little bit less present. And it's the kind of work that I think about, like every day of my life. So I think maybe I just noticed it. And Karen, we absolutely do see that in your story, The Mighty Singer, where the long, you know, it's definitely long-term strategy. It's like hundreds of years. But even in that story, like, it's this old money family and they're like interstellar conglomerate that have this plan and are making it happen. Not really.
I'm gonna stand yes, up for, yes. the, for the old for the old
please,
money.
Family. Please do.
It's
yes,
not, it's not that they have old money. It's that they're a politician's family, so they are very much embedded in the concept of service, public service. So I know that throughout the story, money does become a big deal, and there's another family that comes in and probably like puts in more of the money as well. But even the money is actually a bit more of a collective thing. And it really is about the idea. In fact, Tobias and I discussed this. When Tobias Bekele and I wrote a story, we were supposed to look at big megastructures. It was supposed to be about the building of a planetary ring. What would take to go into that. And in a way, we were looking at both the pros and cons of what we have a lot in our Caribbean region, which is to say a particular family, well, it's not just Caribbean region, it's all over the world, a particular family that always seems to be running for office, that always seems to be, you know, either a public servant in the government or some kind of politician and so forth. And as I said, there are pros and cons to that. With the corruption, it can be very bad. But when they are excellent sort of servants to the society and to the nation, what you have is almost like, you know, when you have families where there have been doctors in the family for generations or priests in the family for generations, there's almost like a family institutional knowledge that grows because they have very direct experience. So it's not so much money there, it's actually this underlying expertise where they're like, we know we can't do this in a big flashy way. We know we can't do this in a way that's noticeable and we get slapped down. So we are farming out these little tasks, like, you know, you're doing the labor songs and the protests and being visible that way. But then we also have this quiet group of, like, you know, cultural attachés who are sort of spies. And we also have this happening. We also have that happening. We're also, you know, buying out shares and whatever. And it becomes a very complex thing. So the way the story puts the Calypsonians front and center, but they got pulled in by people who were like, yeah, we've actually got like various, you know, connections and strings happening because it doesn't just happen because somebody wrote a great song. You know, the song can be the one of the tipping points, but it doesn't just happen because of this one area. It often is a lot of different things. But I'll confess to you, the reason why it's the Calypsonian front and center and not the extra boring bits is because it is hard to write a story that is compelling about that kind of grinding institutional grunt work, you know, that sort of thing. It's not impossible, but it can be challenging to make that seem as exciting as the personal journeys of an individual or a group of individuals.
I think that these are stories that mostly are pinned to a particular moment in time, as Karen was saying. And so it's very hard to show, unless you are going to take on the 100-year view or the 1,000-year view in a very short story, it's very hard to show that institution building happening. There's a lot of stories that show institutions that are coming together, that are being reformed, and we don't really know what the outcome will be. Jamie Gah has a story about corruption in a, I think it's an unnamed South Asian government. and the government is toppled by an army of harpies, which, again, we'd love to see. And we don't know the full outcome of that, but we get the sense that things are changing. Abdullah Mwaswas has a great story about a fantastical future in which the state of Israel relocates to another planet. And the land is returned to Palestinians. And I thought it was interesting what you were saying about labor politics, because that's a story that's very much about labor. It's about what happens when land is returned to you in a damaged state and how much labor you have to do to return it to fertile farmland, to habitable homelands. And I think that in the States, we, in the labor movement especially, because I came up through labor movements and through Marxist organizing, there's a big focus on the idea that the working class comes together and kind of fights the bosses. But if you're in a if you're looking more globally at the context of colonialism and imperialism, labor movements look very, very different because the issues have been focused around forced labor. And so you're not just creating commodities that you don't own. Your entire life isn't yours. Your nation isn't yours. And so the structure of labor resistance looks really, really different than, say, forming a union, because you're not just reforming a labor community. You're reforming an entire community, not just the laborers, but everyone. And so I think one of the things that happens in this book is that because it is global, a lot of people are thinking about labor and institutions through the lens of post-colonialism. And again, that's something in the United States that just gets shoved under the rug. Even though we're a settler colonial nation, people don't think about labor in that context, and they really should.
I do think we were trying to get a balance of different approaches and perspectives, but we weren't overly concerned with having an exact balance either. And it was what people had to write about. And then we kind of tried to do the table of contents a little bit so it felt like you weren't too concentrated in one particular part of the book. I do think one thing that most of us were concerned about is thinking about collective work as opposed to individual heroes saving the day. And so the way that that happens, you know, as we've said, there are a lot of different examples in the book from sort of improvised or just people coming together without too much institution building, as you say. And then there are others where a lot of it is really about the institution, even though, as Annalee said, you know, it's since it's often in a fairly short period of time that the story takes place, it's not always visible what's going on. But certainly like my story, although there's a main character and another character and they do most of the talking between them, they're both part of an organization and a movement. And there's a sense that like this is part of that organization figuring out how it works. And I think there are quite a few stories like that. And like a lot of stories about the difficulty of working in organization. Also about R.B. Lemberg's story. I mean, there are a lot. Sam's story, Sam J. Miller's story. There are quite a few that really deal with these questions of like, okay, so you've got an organization and then either there's a problem or there's one person who doesn't meld with another, or there, you know, suddenly there are different priorities across different subsections. And these are really important issues. And they're, I think also, you know, issues that we don't see enough in fiction. And so thinking about how to write that in a way that's compelling and does leave that uncertainty so that it's not, oh, this person or this subsection of the organization was right and the other one was wrong, or, you know, or is the personality issues that are there even when everyone has the same goals and ideals. So all of that, I think, was really important for us to show.
Yeah, so a lot of things. I mean, like it's the short story form, right? It's like what is possible and compelling in the short story form. And then also a little bit of like, how do you tell a compelling story about the slog of institution building?
Actually, my favorite example of a writer who does try to look at what institution building looks like, but still also realizes that you have to focus on individuals and their path, is when you look at the Foundation series. At least the initial books. But that was also what made it so challenging to film, because, you know, the whole point of especially the early books is that you're not going to get a single person coming and changing this, you know, this tendency, this sort of hewing to the formulae of psychohistory, because this is how societies evolve. And if I haven't reached a tipping point, but, you know, I want to push something through, it's not going to happen because I'm just one person. So it was interesting to read that as a young reader, to read that approach and contrast it with some of the other works, which were very much about, I am one individual who's going to like claim the crown and reform this entire empire or found a new nation or what have you. But, you know, I do feel you can at least do it in a novel or in a series. But yeah, when it comes to short stories, we're beginning to look at snapshots. I mean, even my story of Tobias is a novelette. It's not even a short story because you end up just like adding more and more and more. And it's like, oh goodness, what's important? And even their lives are just snapshots along a timeline that then add up to a lifetime as well.
One of the things that I'll just add to that, my story is about a group of college students trying to create a new organization to challenge the ways that people are being abused and stalked online. And it's based on kind of a misunderstanding of the Constitution. And the person the activist who I interviewed, Cindy Cohn, she's a longstanding digital rights lawyer and activist. And she joked with me like, yeah, I don't think these guys they're creating this organization called Privacy Now. And she's like, don't think this would, you know, pass, congressional scrutiny. But I really wanted to emphasize that oftentimes the beginning of a movement is based on not adhering to definitions from older institutions, but actually trying to reclaim or claim terms like privacy and deploy them in a new way. And so that's one of the things that's messy about movements is that they don't always smoothly come out of a previous generation's ideas. They don't say like, oh, well, let's look at the Constitution and find a little loophole for our movement. They're like, no, actually, we have a whole new set of issues and we're going to redefine privacy for our generation and for the future. And so that's the other messy piece of this, right, is that you may be institution building, but your institution might look really, really weird to the people around you.
That's a very good point. Because, I mean, as you say, it's a generational project, but even from generation to generation, the goals are going to change, the approach is going to change, and that's all part of the uncertainty and the complexity.
Yeah.
Well, and I love, Annalee, the conversation between your story and Charlie Jane Anders' story, which is realer than real, which is in some ways about like also an interpretation of an old tradition or a story, but like using
being
it
literal
for their own purposes.
Being very literal-minded and using that as a form of protest. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like a reclamation of the concept of originalism for trans liberation. There's messiness, generative messiness on many fronts. Sweet. So as we kind of get into our wrap-up time here, this is a little bit of a callback to our conversation about like ambiguity and the fact that this book really isn't prescriptive. It's not at any point like these are the things you have to do. But the blurb on the back of the book says, "We Will Rise Again is a guide for imagining a better future." And so For each of you, like as you think about this book now being out in the world, how do you hope that people will take it up and use it in the world?
I think that for us, however people find it useful, you know, if it's useful because it gives someone a couple of hours of feeling good, I'm quite happy with that. And if it's useful because it gives someone a specific idea, that's awesome. And if it's useful because it gives someone the little push they need to go and join a neighborhood group, that's incredible. And if it's just useful because every time someone thinks, they keep telling us it's always going to be this way. And then they think, oh yeah, but remember that story? It felt like it really could be different. Like that's amazing. So, you know, we want to make the world a little bit better and all of those things do that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things for me, going back to something you said much earlier, when you mentioned that we don't really adhere to genre, we're mixing it up a lot. I want people to literally start thinking outside the box. And I think that the fact that we are mixed a lot of genres together kind of helps with that. right now, when we're getting some of the reader feedback, we're seeing some people who are not much into science fiction or fantasy, but they're really fascinated by the essays. And then reading the essay and seeing the context makes them interested in looking at the story and happier to approach the story in a way they would not have done if it just was sent to them cold, you know, as a non-SF reader. So if we are helping people to find new ways to imagine, you know, new ways of finding inspiration, I think that is also very useful because sometimes our methods are not bad, but they may be stale, they need a little shake up, whatever. So if this anthology as well can just shake things up a bit, get us out of our usual ruts of thinking, I think that would be very useful.
Yeah, one of the ways that Adrienne Marie Brown and Walida Imarisha inspired us is that they, with their book, they went around the country and they had lots of workshops for people teaching them to write stories that were alternatives to their realities. And I would love it if, you know, people read this book and thought, well, I'm an activist, but I have some ideas that I could put into fiction. And, you know, if a bunch of new fiction came out of it, I would be so happy. I would just love to see more people thinking of fiction as not just an escape, but a tool. I mean, it's both. Like, I'm not saying if it's a tool of liberation, it's not escapism. but people acknowledging that fiction has this role, this really vital political role in our lives.
Oh, and I most of all hope that they find that this is an anthology with amazing reread capacity. I want people to be able to dip back into this book, dip into it and dip out of it, dip into it and dip out of it for whatever they need and maybe find something new each time.
I have already been thinking about that because this book arrived at my house not that long ago, you know, just a couple of days after the publication date. So this first read was a little bit of a fast one. And I really am like deeply looking forward to going back to it over time. And I think, you know, and again, I have experienced this with some of the, you know, classics of science fiction that I've like reread over my lifetime, is that I change as I grow and learn things and do more things in the world. And I think like my relationship with these stories will also change. And that's really something I'm looking forward to. And yeah, thinking of having read all of these stories in the last 2 weeks, something that I love about a short story collection is I feel like my head becomes like home to all of these different characters and their worlds. And there's just like a little bit of a like cacophony for a while. There's just like all of these people in my head together. But it's really lovely. And I don't know, it's energizing for me. And so to celebrate all of the characters, because they're all amazing, but also maybe to give listeners just a few more little tastes of the stories, who is a character who you still think about? And what is it about them that has stuck with you? And I will say that for me, I have thought so much about Ophelia, the main character of Chupacabras, who is just an incredible character, like having a rough time of it as a parent, you know, experiencing such grief about the loss of culture and environment in her home place. And then, you know, with this incredible like rage that is somehow like terrifying, but also alluring, that she, you know, experiences throughout the story. She has been on my heart.
Aww. I think for me, it's the story When Memory Meets the Sea, which is just so, it's so much. And that character's experience and emotional connection and journey, yeah, it just strikes me every time.
For me, it's Other Wars Elsewhere. There's that bit, especially the scene where it's almost like a little bit of a cozy haven, and the giant is having their sweater re-knitted, and there's this talk about unbittering yourself. And that whole concept, that whole scene, that whole idea that, you know, whatever your struggles outside, whatever your sufferings and so forth, there's a moment where you just have to sit and, with the help of others, kind of unknit the stuff that's all tangled and tainted and hurt and re-knit it into something that is kind of refreshed and clean. I mean, this is one of the beauties of speculative fiction for me, that you can put an image to that that's not a realism image, but it's so vivid in a way it teaches you what you need to do in your life.
So that's the first story. Otherwise, Elsewhere is the first story in the collection. And I did read them in order. And yeah, in that story, in that scene that you're describing, there's a moment where the main character is like, yeah, the people in my organization think we have to stop, you know, working on this war that I've been working on and move on to the next one. And one of the other characters she's talking to in this like cozy kitchen is like, but you don't want to move on. That's not what you want. And there's just something about that moment of like kindness and like deep listening. That was the first moment in the anthology, in the experience of reading the collection, the first of many where I was like, oh, I felt that in my soul. So
nice.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
I think a lot about Kifa and the gospel, which I mentioned earlier. And I think it's because it's a story about it's set in the far future where Palestinians are kind of re-agriculturizing. They're bringing the land back into fertility after it's been destroyed by war and pollution. And it's so far in the future that the current war that we're experiencing and the genocide are just long forgotten. And Kifa is just a kid, and he stumbles across this robot wandering around outside of his family's town. And the robot is actually, it turns out, named Gospel, and is a relic from our era. And it's basically an AI in robot form, and all it does is spew propaganda, like anti-Palestinian propaganda. And it's now just so weird that the kid is like, it's just absurd to this kid. And the kid is fascinated by it. Like, why do you keep saying all this weird, wrong stuff? And it's very, the story itself is very satirical. It's intended to be, you know, a kind of sarcastic commentary on a lot of the propaganda that we encounter online, a lot of it now being made by AI. And I think about that all the time because I get a lot of hope from thinking about a future where so many of the things that people are taking seriously now are revealed as the absurd propaganda that they are, and that we reach a moment where we can all just say, like, wow, that was ridiculous.
Yes, that was messed up.
That was just crazy. And why did people take this seriously? And yeah. I think that's, you know, the kind of the beauty of satire in a lot of ways is that it reminds us that, you know, we need to remember that a lot of this stuff is just foolish. And it's not just deadly, it's also silly. And those are sometimes kind of two sides of the same coin. And so I think about that robot all the time and just like, I cannot wait for all this AI to be a museum piece. And yeah, it's happy to be in that place in that future.
Yeah, there's such a feeling of like, we live in just the stupidest timeline. Like, we just live in the worst timeline. Like, why, how could all of this absurdity and all this horror be happening? Like, as flip sides of one another. So yeah, I like a future in which that is not what we are experiencing and the absurd horrors are revealed in their absurdity.
Yeah,
I would definitely feel that as a better future. I think that does it for our conversation today. So Karen Lord, Malka Older, Annalee Newitz, it's a wonderful book. Thank you for dreaming it into being. And thank you so, so much for coming on Write on Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Karen Lord is a Barbadian editor and writer of multiple science fiction and fantasy series. And if you thought that the anthology that we discussed today sounded interesting, she is also the editor of the collection New Worlds, Old Ways, Speculative Tales from the Caribbean. You can find her on Blue Sky at Dr. Karen Lord. Annalee Newitz is a science fiction writer and science journalist, and most recently the author of Automatic Noodle, a USA Today bestseller. You can find them on Blue Sky at Annalie N and find all their updates at www.texploitation.com. Malka Older is an aid worker, sociologist, and writer of science fiction, including the cozy space opera mystery series that begins with The Mimicking of Known Successes. You can find her on Blue Sky at Older, O-L-D-E-R. All of this information is in the show notes, either on your podcast feed or on the KFAI website, along with a link to Where Memory Meets the Sea, which is the story that Malka mentioned at the very end of the interview. And you can read that for free online to get a little taste of the collection. And again, my name is Molly. This is Write On Radio. I am a member of the Write On Radio Collective. And just a thank you from me. This is my very first Write On Radio interview, and basically my first interview in general. So thank you for being here. If you're tuning in live over the broadcast or later on the podcast feed, thank you. And more interviews on speculative fiction and adjacent topics to come. And thank you so much for listening to Fresh Air Community Radio. That's KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Until next week, bye.